Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 2nd of April. A breakthrough on immigration due to compromise? A moment of bipartisanship? It's instructive, according to our guest, to look back at history when we examine this. At a time when Congress passed two landmark civil rights measures, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, both were highly controversial, but ultimately they went through as a result of bipartisan deals. Joining us this hour is Professor Julian Zelizer, Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University. He's written so many books that examine U.S. political leaders, policies, and institutions since the New Deal. His most recent books are Governing America, The Revival of Political History, Jimmy Carter, Conservatives in Power, The Reagan Years, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, and The Presidency of George W. Bush. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Zelizer, and here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page, should you care to use that, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Zelizer, a pleasure to speak with you again. Good morning, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. The stars, you write, seem to be aligning for immigration reform. Isn't that something?
Yeah, we're getting close. There's no deal yet, and in Congress, even when something's close, it doesn't mean it's guaranteed. But the political incentives are pushing both parties towards some kind of a deal. Most of the leaders in both parties are indicating that they are pretty close to a framework for an agreement, and the president himself obviously has a strong interest in making this happen. So the odds are good in what's been called a dysfunctional Congress that we could very well have a breakthrough on immigration policy.
So did all of the members of the Gang of Eight and others decide to take a crash course in the art of compromise?
Well, yes, they always know how to do that. The question is when politics pushes them that way. I think obviously the two things have happened. One is just the ongoing pressure to deal and respond to a huge and growing part of the electorate that is composed of immigrants as well as older immigrants, which includes the rest of us, who favor more liberal immigration policy. And that's been building for decades, and Republicans like George W. Bush have been in favor of a more liberal immigration policy for a good time now. And then at the same time, the election of 2012 just scared a lot of Republicans who are looking at the map and seeing that if they don't catch up with demographics, demographics will catch up with them, and they won't be able to win presidential races and even congressional races in years to come.
So that's really what's pushing it. The Republicans have to get those votes?
That's a big part of it. Look, the Republican Party has been divided in recent years on immigration. There is a half of the Republican Party that really does believe in a more liberal policy. A part of it is they look at the votes. Part of it is the business community is very much in favor of having more immigrants who will be part of the workforce. And part of it is there are many Republicans who are not hardline restrictionists. This is a tradition of the party, and who are very much in favor of having a pluralistic, diverse country. That's been at odds with another part of the party that's more hardline restrictionist, and that's been growing and more vocal in recent years. And so the question is which part of the Republican Party would win out. And the election and the votes have pushed the GOP a little closer to the side of the liberal side of the party.
I love the fact that you're a historian, because you can now give us a history of how the Republican Party dealt with immigration in the 1960s and long before that.
Well, the Republicans have always been a party with a strong pro-immigration stance. You saw this at the turn of the 20th century, the progressive era of American politics between the 1900s and 1920s. That's when we had Eastern and Southern Europeans coming into the country. And there is a period where you have just huge inflows of immigrants, and many Republicans are in favor of this. Some of them are very insistent on quote-unquote Americanizing immigrants when they come here, teaching them American values, culture, even hygiene. That's what people like Teddy Roosevelt talked about. But they were in favor of immigration as business was during that period because immigrants provided a core to the workforce. During the 1960s, we have another period of immigration reform where we try to end restrictions that were put into place in the 1920s. And there's many Republicans who, again, are on the liberal side of this issue. They're very much in favor of ending restrictions and getting rid of the kind of nativist prohibitions that ended the last period of immigration. And so we've had the same thing in recent decades. Again, I mentioned President George W. Bush, who since his time in Texas has always lived in a state filled with immigrants, and he has never been favorable toward the restrictionist part of his political party and was very frustrated with it when he tried to pass immigration reform. So in all the periods of immigration, you've had a lot of Republicans who are not on the restrictionist side of this debate.
So how did the restrictionist part come into being?
Well, it's always been there, and just as immigration is as American as apple pie, so are restrictionists in both parties. There are many Democrats, for example, often with the support of labor, who've pushed to cut down the number of immigrants who could come in here and compete with workers in the labor force. But Republicans have always had this element. Again, back in the progressive era, there were Republicans who bought into eugenics research that argued that some immigrants were lesser mentally and physically than people who are already in the country. In recent years, you've seen it in places like Arizona. It's been tied up to the right wing of the party. Some call it Tea Party Republicans. Some just call it the right wing. But fighting against allowing immigrants into the country has become one of the issues that animates the right in the GOP. And I think the 2010 election really accelerated and amplified their presence in the party. But it's been around for a while. Again, George W. Bush, when he pushed for immigration reform, really was fighting with this part of his party that just becomes stronger and stronger in recent years.
And what about President Ronald Reagan? You write about his signing a bill providing amnesty for almost 3 million illegal immigrants. Was there opposition to that?
Oh, yes, there was opposition to that. There were and remain many critics of Reagan who argued that that piece of reform, which was very important to him, failed on the side of the legislation that was meant to create sanctions on employers who hired illegal immigrants. And many Republicans today and Republicans at the time argue that it was a failed policy that failed to stop the inflow of immigration and did just the opposite. Reagan, too, this was not a core part of his conservative principles, fighting against immigration. And you know, he was rather enthused to go along with this legislation. But he had his critics as well. So it's really been something of a civil war in the party on how to deal with this issue. I think Democrats have had the same thing, and it's often been around the issue of labor and work. But that tension has diminished in many ways, whereas in the Republican Party, it's become stronger in recent decades.
Mm-hmm. And why, Professor Zelizer, has labor softened opposition? There is relatively high unemployment in this country. Why aren't they saying American workers can fill these jobs?
First, I assume that part of it is the way the immigrant the workforce itself has changed. I mean, we've had the inflow of immigrants have been coming in this flow since the 1965 reform passed, and in the last two decades the workforce has changed. So when you're talking about labor, they are not separate from the immigrants who are coming into the country. So I assume there are many workers who would not be in favor of organized labor taking a hard line stand against people who are from their families, from the same countries. There are strong ties that connect them together. I also think, you know, they see this as part of a broader coalition at this point against conservative policies that would be punitive both to workers here already, immigrants who have already come into the country, and immigrants who might come in the future. I think in many ways, the same way organized labor joined forces with the civil rights movement in the 1960s, you're seeing labor become part of a more progressive coalition and reach deals, as we saw this week, on how visas should be handled, so that they are not at odds with liberal immigration advocates, but rather, you know, part of a team.
And what about businesses? What kinds of workers are they in need of?
Businesses in need of many workers, including high-skilled workers, and you know, they don't. There's different kinds of businesses in the country. There's many businesses that depend on unskilled immigrant labor in places such as suburbs and in urban centers. And there are many high-tech companies that very much depend on very skilled, educated immigrant workers coming into this country. So I don't think there's one kind of worker that they're looking for. And that's part of why business is never really on the side of restricting immigration. And given the role of business in the Republican Party, that creates a huge problem for the party when the hardline restrictionist elements become more vocal.
Mm-hmm. In a recent piece, you wrote this: what needs to happen to close a deal, you ask? It's instructive to look back at when Congress passed two landmark civil rights measures, Civil Rights Act of 64, Voting Rights Act of 65. Both, you say, were highly controversial, but ultimately they went through as a result of bipartisan deals. So inform us, what happened then and how is it instructive for now?
Well, one thing that happened, which was extremely important, was that civil rights activists put a lot of pressure in the districts and states of moderate or undecided Republicans on civil rights issues. So the grassroots always understood that it was important to the legislative process in Washington. And today there was an interesting article, I believe, in the New York Times, how activists are starting to focus on key districts right now to build pressure. So Everett Dirksen in the 1960s was a Senate minority leader. He was the key Republican in the Senate, and he was really going to determine whether a civil rights bill, for example, in 1964 passed or not, because he could bring enough Republicans to end the filibuster. So civil rights activists mobilized in Illinois, his home state. They conducted protests in places like Chicago. They threatened to have protests near his home if he didn't agree to the legislation, really to embarrass him and create pressure. And that was extremely important in the end to moving members of Congress toward the side of civil rights. And I think right now that would be extremely important as well in the coming weeks, when there's going to be many people hesitating and trying to figure out what to do. A second thing that was very important was Lyndon Johnson was insistent that Democrats allow Everett Dirksen to take credit for a lot of the legislation, to play to his ego, to make him feel like he was really the kingmaker. And many Democrats and civil rights activists didn't like this. Dirksen was a Midwestern conservative, and Johnson was insisting on allowing really an opponent to take credit for his legislation. And I think right now Obama is going to need to do some of that, and someone like Senator Rubio is going to get angry if he is moved out or pushed away from the final resolution. Mm. And I think that's part of what you're seeing this week. So I think that's a really instructive lesson, especially given the news that came out today.
So Obama will be likely to give Rubio credit?
Well, I think he's going to have to. I mean, I think certainly if we look at the 1960s as something of a model or something of a framework for reaching a deal, it doesn't mean he has to give credit to Rubio for immigration reform, but he certainly has to share in that. And he certainly has to make someone like a Rubio feel that he's coming out of a deal with a lot, even if it means coming out with something he could run on in 2016. That's how politicians work. That's how senators work. And that was very important to Johnson. You know, Johnson told Senator Hubert Humphrey, who was handling the 1964 civil rights bill, he told him, you get in there and see Dirksen, you drink with Dirksen, talk to Dirksen, listen to Dirksen, and just make him feel like the king. And I think even in an age where you have such intense polarization, I still think that's going to be important. You can't have Chuck Schumer simply going on TV announcing the deal and making the Republicans feel like not only did you lose in 2012, but you're not even going to get credit for reaching this kind of deal. I don't think that's going to work. So they're going to have to share.
Immigration reform, the stars seem to be aligning, according to our guest, and he gives us a historical perspective on why. A moment of compromise, bipartisanship, is this the wave of the future? Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest. He joins us pretty often here on the Ideas Network. And here is our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email, talk at WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You may have more questions about the history of immigration, which is a fascinating topic in this country, or you may have comments about why the time seems to be ripe now for immigration reform. We have yet to talk about the details of the immigration reform deal that appears to be there. Lines are open for you at this very moment, so join us. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Lynn Olson, has a new book. We've interviewed her on several of her other books. The new one is Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II, 1939 to 1941. She looks at the interventionists and the isolationists and the incredible debate that took place that probably isn't very well publicized. So she's done just that. It should be a fascinating hour. Coming up, hour two. Professor Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton, is our guest this hour, and we're talking about immigration reform and looking at historically where we've been on this issue and why it is that we appear to be reaching a compromise at this point in history. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you now. Lou in Cudahy is our first caller. Hi, Lou.
Hi there. I heard Senator Schumer talking that he's basically saying a deal's already been cut. I don't think it works quite that way. The second thing he said was that the borders would be secure. It's not the first item. Republicans and conservatives are going to demand first that the border be secure, and that's not the way it's running now. And second, this will be a dedicated group of people who are put in narcotic dependency. All the illegal aliens giving a path to citizenship who now will vote Democrat. It's about first victimhood and second dependency. Identify a victim and then put them in the narcotic dependency. That's really how this works for Democrats.
Professor Zelizer.
The key issue will be the border control issue in terms of winning over Republicans who are still opposed to this. And Rubio's already raised questions about how that will work. Border control is the issue that animates much of the right. And so it is true that this will be one of the questions that still needs to be worked out over the next few weeks. And symbolically, I think it's going to be very important for the Republicans who are on the liberal side of this question to be able to come back to the conservatives and say, we have some kind of border control measure in place. So it's true, and I do think that's going to be something you see discussed in these final weeks. To the first point, there is no deal, and that is true. The stars are aligned. There's all these incentives in place. All the major players seem to be saying go. But as we know in Congress, success is never inevitable, and even the most likely deal can fall apart. So this will be part of the politics of the issue in terms of how to handle this. Again, no one is calling for totally open doors to immigration. Border control has always been part of this, always been part of this for the Obama administration. But they're balancing that with a path to citizenship for the 11 million who are already here and dealing with these other issues like allowing businesses to bring in workers where there are no U.S. workers to fill those jobs.
Haven't we already spent a huge amount of money on border control?
We have, and it's not one of our best expenditures. It's certainly not one of our most efficient expenditures. And so, you know, a lot of the discussion revolves around simply how to tighten our borders, but probably a better discussion would be to really think about how the whole system works, to make it more efficient, more effective, and less costly. But at this point, that's not the discussion we have, and I think all eyes are really toward the path to citizenship question, because that's really the most pressing issue right now on the table for many people, since these are people who are already here trying to figure out their futures.
And what about Lou's point that if all these people are allowed a path to citizenship, they're going to vote Democratic?
Well, maybe, but we don't know that. It's always hard to predict the electorate. There's been many conservatives who argue that there are many immigrants who are, you know, more conservative in a lot of their politics than Democrats would like. And obviously right now, if this becomes a Democratic bill rather than a bipartisan bill, many immigrants, those 11 million, might feel a lot of loyalty to the party for some time to come. You know, African Americans have been loyal to the Democratic Party in part because of current policies, but also because of the 64 and 65 Act that Johnson was president for when that happened. And so, you know, that is a fear. But the reality is the electorate can change, and we don't know how they will vote. They are not necessarily going to be the immigrant bloc. Right now, they are the immigrants we are dealing with in terms of policy, but they might vote very differently in years to come.
Mm-hmm. Because of their conservative stance on social issues?
It could be their conservative stance on social issues. Pockets of this group could also vote conservative on economic issues. Many are going to become very involved in small businesses, for example, where there's often a conservative bias against taxation and regulation. So social issues, economic issues, all that could unravel what might be part of the Democratic coalition in the next, you know, decade or so.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. But certainly both parties sense if they are not on board with this legislation, if one party is saying no, meaning the Republicans, this could be part of the Democratic voting bloc for longer.
Thanks, Lou, for the number or for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Kevin in Hudson, hi.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Immigration has been a hot topic amongst our friends, and it always seems to come back to the core problem of immigration, and that is that most of the immigrants are here for jobs. And the discussion always revolves around if businesses would have been fined substantially for hiring immigrants, we wouldn't have a problem anymore. We would not have this problem. I'd like to hear your speaker's comments, please.
All right. Thanks, Kevin.
The last part of the question cut off. Can you just repeat the last part?
If businesses were fined, we wouldn't have this problem anymore.
If businesses were fined, meaning if you had, you know, economic growth, that this wouldn't be an issue. There is always a more tension over immigration in hard economic times because you have, when there's global hard economic times, it obviously increases the flow of immigrants who are looking for jobs, who are coming to the country. And when the times are hard in the U.S., immigration becomes a zero-sum game. So it's true that many workers, when the economy is doing bad, will say, hey, why should we allow new workers to enter the country? We don't have jobs, as opposed to a period of economic growth like the 1950s and 60s, when that doesn't really seem like a trade-off that's going to be a problem, that business could ultimately hire both. And so we are still in an economic context where some of these tensions, as we've seen in the last decade, are exacerbated just because of how poorly the economy is performing.
Let's go next to Bill in Madison. Hi.
The guess parallels between the 1964 Voting Rights Act and earlier progressive legislation in the early part of the 20th century, I think, is a little off the mark in that he fails to take into account the collapse of old-style machine politics where political candidates are determined by state organizations, political caucuses, etc. Nowadays, politicians are running scared because if they anger the base of the most extreme elements of their party, they're going to be challenged in primaries that are up for elections that mainly the most radically the most radical parts of the party turn out for. So I don't think that you can really draw good parallels because the way that candidates are chosen for Congress and Senate are different from the way they were back in those days.
That's a good point. The Voting Rights Act was in 1965. But the major point about the change in the political process certainly is valid. And the politicians, as they lose control over the nomination process and as the party machines diminished in importance and activists and interest groups become more important because of how the primaries work, it does give room for activists on the far right to have more of a role than they might have. That said, you have to remember that civil rights angered the most powerful base of the Democratic Party, for sure, the Southern Democrats, who controlled all the committees in Congress, who were incredibly influential in the nomination process. So even though the nominations were more structured in the 1960s, those were the very bosses civil rights angered. So it was comparable in that way, and in some ways even more potent, because the Southerners had such overwhelming control of the Democratic Party that when Johnson, himself a Southerner, went for this bill, he was enraging the people who could cause the most damage. There's a famous story that the night of the Civil Rights Act being signed, Lyndon Johnson sitting in the White House, and Bill Moyers, who was his speechwriter and an advisor, finds him, and he looks forlorn and depressed, and he can't understand why Johnson's so sad after having finally won on the Civil Rights Bill. And Johnson says, "I probably just gave away the South to the Republican Party for decades to come." So there were comparisons, and you can even see some of those kinds of tensions are the very ones that Republicans right now are dealing with.
When you say what Republicans do on immigration will have huge consequences for the direction of the party, what do you mean?
Well, at the most basic level, if they say no, if they become the party that's holding back on this legislation, or if they become the party that's somehow dragged into a deal where Democrats use partisan muscle to strong-arm them, but it's clear the Republicans don't want this, this part of the electorate will remember that. People who are already citizens, people who do get the vote, regardless of what happens, are going to remember that the Republicans were the party of no. They said no to them. They didn't want them in the country. They didn't want them as part of the citizenry. And that could have negative political repercussions. The Republicans are struggling right now. The demographics don't work in their favor. They're losing with younger voters. They're losing with immigrant voters. They're losing with women voters. And if they ultimately block this, I think it's going to be a big problem electorally. And I think also symbolically, you know, this is a way, ironically, for them to get a big issue off the table and focus on areas where they might do better, on economic questions, regulatory questions, even environmental questions, where Republicans might have stronger ground. If they get tied up and if this, you know, wraps up Congress for a while and this defines their party rather than other issues, they might lose opportunities to succeed. So there's electoral repercussions, other kinds of policy repercussions. I think there's a lot for them to lose right now.
Bill, thanks for the call. Ken in Mundelein, Illinois. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I really think that we have a moral obligation to provide a path to citizenship, because it's really our culture, you know, American culture and business, that has allowed illegal immigration to be such a big thing. I mean, we really rely on a very large illegal labor pool to, you know, to maintain large parts of our economy, like agriculture. And I, you know, it's kind of like, you know, and not to be derogatory, but, you know, you're blaming the flies for coming to the honey when we're the people that leave the honey out, essentially. And so I don't understand why we can be so negative on this class of people, and by you know, we conservative people, when it's really, you know, us that have brought them here. And so the whole, you know, shutting down the border, and, you know, I mean, we're drawing them here on purpose, essentially. So I really think that if we want to, you know, stop the problem, then, you know, we really need to crack down on businesses that hire these people. I mean, I remember, I think it was either in Texas or Louisiana, there was some kind of law that went into effect about, you know, you can't, you know, if you hire an illegal immigrant, you go to jail, et cetera. But they gave a big exemption for domestic workers, because they said, oh, well, you know, there's so many maids and nannies and such that if we try, you know, we don't want to put every housewife in, you know, in our town in jail, essentially. And so it just reeks of hypocrisy, I think.
Well, those are very fair points. I mean, there's all kinds of moral, ethical, parts of this debate that get lost in the politics. So we do focus on what does this mean for Party A and Party B, what's the game behind the legislation, but there's also, as it was with civil rights and other periods of immigration reform, a basic ethical question about what we do, and part of that is what the caller raised. A lot of the influx of immigrants is not simply people randomly running through the border. A business is very eager to have immigrants here for the workforce, often to take jobs that no one else is taking. And it's not just businesses. It's often families, suburban families, who hire immigrant labor for all sorts of issues, from lawn care to domestic service. So there is something of a hypocrisy in that we have been the source of demand, and now we're having a question about what to do with the people who have come here and filled that demand. And I think there are many people who agree with the caller, and that's why they think this path to citizenship is not just a part of the legislation. It is the center, the core of the legislation, and that we have an obligation as a nation to provide clarity and provide permanence to this population.
How do you factor in, which is something I always think about, and all of us do, we all have grandparents or great-grandparents or parents who have come from other countries. We are, to state the obvious, a nation of immigrants. It's very deeply woven into what America is.
We are all immigrants, and so when you teach an undergraduate course on the United States and you ask, you know, who comes from a family that was here at the founding of the country, and they themselves would obviously be immigrants, very few will raise their hands in any kind of university, state, public, elite, non-elite. Everyone comes from an immigrant background. So the whole debate over immigration is very odd, and there's often a big disconnect between the realities of our own past and the realities of this nation being deeply woven into all the immigration influxes that we've had, the ways of immigrants we've had over the centuries, that, you know, we need to think about that. We need to incorporate that as we have these discussions about what to do today.
Right.
But this is an immigrant nation. There's no denying that, and the history shows that very clearly.
Professor Zelizer, what would happen if we just said, we're opening the doors, come on in?
Well, that won't happen, and I think there'd be all kinds of opposition. I don't know what the numbers would be, how many more people would actually come. It's interesting. There's places such as Mexico right now where the influx of immigrants has diminished because the economy's doing better, and so there's less interest in coming here. People don't move automatically. They don't move easily. Even in hard economic times, no one likes to uproot themselves and move certainly from one country to another, often without their families or often with only part of their families, going into a place they don't know about and they don't know how it's going to work and what their futures are going to be like. So immigration is not easy. I don't think you open the doors. It's unclear, you know, how much more you would see. But that's not going to happen anyway, and no one's talking about that. So we're talking about how to create restrictions that are fair and humane, and at the same time, how do we allow the immigrants who are very much needed and wanted in this country to come in and have some stability in what the process of legalization will be.
Professor Julian Zelizer is our guest, and we're talking about comprehensive immigration legislation. It looks as though Congress might be close to comprehensive immigration legislation. Compromise, the art of compromise, has been remembered, or it's being practiced right now. We're looking at a lot of issues, the history of immigration in this country, what the current compromise looks like, why politically now is the time for immigration reform to actually become a reality. That's what is being discussed this hour with Professor Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and author of a number of books, to mention just a couple of them. Most recently, Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He's written a lot of presidential history books on Jimmy Carter, on Ronald Reagan, on George W. Bush. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our lines are busy right now. You may want to send an email, if you get frustrated because you can't get through. That's talk@WPR.org. Or our Facebook page, where we love to read messages whenever you'd like to post them, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Lynn Olson will join us again. She was with us after her book prior to the book that we're talking about today. Today's book is Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II from 1939 to 1941, a time that she feels has not been written about very extensively, and it's absolutely fascinating. So the fight primarily centered a lot of characters, but Lindbergh and Roosevelt, the major characters here, and what a story. What a story. Back to phone calls now for Professor Julian Zelizer. Nate in Appleton, hi.
Yeah, I think people don't understand the full scope of how they illegal immigrants contribute to the economy. They provide like a shock absorber for the economy. When the economy heats up, you can add on workers. A lot of these workers are under the table. The other part of it is when the economy slows down, the illegal workers, the ones that are not contributing to Social Security, they can be let go. They don't have to pay for unemployment. They don't have to pay for health care. But the critical fact is this. 90% of these people need Social Security cards to get employment. They make contributions to the Social Security Trust Fund through their payroll taxes. That's automatic. They have to do it. The IRS and the Treasury Department calculated that the contribution that they make to the Social Security Trust Fund, from which they will never draw any benefits out, amounted to almost $200 billion with a B dollars in the 1990s. So these folks are subsidizing the exact people who are voting against them.
Professor Zelizer.
Well, that's true. And, you know, immigrants have been important to some of the improvements in the short-term status of Social Security. Immigrants contribute to the economic health of the country in all kinds of sectors, from nursing to, as we talked about, the suburban economy. And beyond the economics that the caller is talking about, immigrants have contributed hugely to the culture and to the social dynamics of the nation, including those who ironically are against immigration. So economics, social security, culture, and society is all shaped by the very people who are often the focus of attack by these opponents.
We go to Simaj in Portage County. Hi.
Hello. Sure. I just wanted to point out, and this was part of my education, I stayed at a motel in a neighboring state, and the men that ran the motel were from Croatia, and they gave me the education that there were thousands and thousands of men and women that came into the United States illegally from Bosnia, Herzegovina, Croatia, Serbia, Macedonia, Slovenia, because they ran away from the war, from the wars, plural, that were happening in that part of the world during the 1990s. We seem to be obsessed with Central America, where that is not necessarily the fact. Now, I am neither pro nor con, but nevertheless, I would like to make the listeners aware of that.
All right, Simaj, thank you.
Yes, that's a true point and a good point. The reason that immigrants come here, they're numerous. Some are what we've talked about, economic reasons, people looking for better lives, for more opportunities to accumulate wealth and protect their families. Others come not because they are that enthused about coming to the United States, but because they're fleeing from horrible circumstances, including the wars of the mid-1990s, where I'm sure large parts of the population arrived because of those facts. And so, you know, there are multiple reasons. Some want to focus on the economic reasons because they're easier to discuss politically in some ways than dealing with populations who fled here for their lives, which makes things harder politically in terms of the opposition. But any discussion of immigration should certainly talk about the distinct reasons different parts of the population are here.
Is it hard to get political asylum in this country?
Yes, I think it has become. I think some of the post 9/11 laws have been part of the problem that advocates have discussed. It's created certain restrictions for legitimate reasons of trying to protect the home front that need to be addressed and need to be revisited, especially as the conditions overseas have changed and the kinds of threats that we face change.
You talk about, and I want to spend a little bit of time on this because not too many people write about this. The news media, you write in a CNN column, have always been a powerful force in our society. At times, they have helped push our political system toward reform. Right now, a new generation of reporters can shine by taking on the biggest stories of the day that would have long-term impact on the direction of our country. How has the press, it's a general question, but take it where you want, dealt with the issue of reform, immigration reform?
It's been interesting. I don't think a lot of the press has handled it that well. I think a lot of the discussion that you do see in the media has focused on the horse race, just as we do with elections, trying to understand primarily the behind-the-scenes maneuvering of different politicians, of different interest groups, as we saw this week, accords that are reached or deals that fall apart, all of which are extremely important. But what you see less of are stories on the populations that we're talking about. These 11 million people remain generally a number. They don't. They are not seen. They are not heard. The conditions of those who are in this country, what they're doing for the labor force, all the kinds of questions that came up over the past hour, I don't think receive that much attention. The difficulties and challenges that people who come to this country face, and the reason that a path for citizenship is so important, and understanding and knowing that there's some kind of stable process that will be created, I think the media would do very well to talk more about that. And back in the 60s, where we've been discussing the role of younger journalists in television and in print in uncovering race relations in places such as the South and talking about the brutality that often existed in terms of how local law enforcement treated African Americans and covering issues of poverty and racial discrimination became extremely important to galvanizing public support, but also to strengthening public understanding of the issue of race. And that generation of reporters, civil rights was really very important in forming who they were and it's showing what television could do as a medium, really mm-hmm. important. And I think there's an opportunity now for the bloggers and for internet journalists who are this new generation with a new medium to show what they can do by looking a little more deeply at immigration, both now and even if a deal passes in the year that follows as this all falls into place.
But in those days, I'm thinking of Edward R. Murrow and Harvest of Shame. Those were major networks. That was a major network. Can you get the kind of interest in this if you're doing an audience that doesn't have that many people? The major networks aren't going to look at immigration reform, are they, in any kind of special? Those days have gone by the wayside.
Absolutely. Look, it's much harder. I mean, you had a level of centralization. It's what you're talking about back in the 1960s. So if one network broadcast a show or one journalist such as Murrow had a special, everyone would see it, or a large portion of the
yes.
news viewing public would see it. You don't have that anymore. But that said, you know, just think of the power of YouTube in showing some of the sillier things that
mm-hmm.
happen on a daily basis and how many people view it through social media and through links to places like Real Clear Politics or whatever site people like. There still is the ability to convey information very fast. Think of our weather disasters we've gone through. I mean, the amount of information people have about how weather patterns are emerging and when a storm is going to hit sometimes reaches kind of levels of parity but also is also extremely helpful and shows what the new media can do for preparation. Why not do that with some of the other big questions that we face? We have storms, but we also have issues like immigration. And so the new media, I think, is capable of a lot, but we haven't really deployed it for some kinds of questions, and this is one of them.
Mm-hmm. A couple lines have opened. If you'd like to join us on immigration reform, 800-486-8655 is our number. John in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sure. I'll try to be brief. I've got two parts to my comment. The first is that I've got two Hispanic sister-in-laws, first and second generation. I'm like fourth or fifth generation like myself. But I'm a very liberal-minded person when it comes to immigration reform. I think almost open-door policy is what I personally believe. And I was elated when I first heard about the compromise that's actually going on, like the actual function of Congress or functionality of Congress with this immigration reform. However, and this is a pretty big but, I'm probably voting Republican no matter what their stance on immigration reform in the next election, maybe next couple of elections, because I have a list of values and I have them weighted, and the first value to me is freedom of firearms. And so that's, there's multiple issues, and I would be conflicted if Republicans stopped compromising, but to me, hopefully the compromise will continue, and I'm happy to hear about it. But that's it. Thank you for letting me express my opinion.
Thank you, John.
Well, that's a fair point. I think it plays out two ways. There are Republicans, and there's certainly parts of the Republican Party that this will not decide what they do. So Republicans say no to immigration. It's not going to somehow flip them to the Democratic side. But the question for the Republican Party is if this becomes defining, if this becomes a defining stand for the GOP, are there not many moderates, are there not many Republicans who are even conservative and agree with the party on 99% of the questions, but will see this because of family members, because of friends, because of the moral dimension, because of the economics, as a reason to either not vote or as a reason, worse for the Republicans to leave the party. And so I think that's a calculation, a crass calculation a lot of Republican leaders are making, and many feel right now that if they say no to immigration, it will overshadow all the other questions that the caller just talked about.
Mm-hmm. The president will be in Colorado tomorrow talking about firearms, and that is the focus of our 9 a.m. conversation tomorrow morning. Paul in La Crosse, hi. Hello, Paul.
Oh, hi, yes. I'll just... something came up in Minneapolis that a guy was trying to get the citizenship for his grandma. She died in 1926. In 1907, Congress passed a law saying that any woman who married an immigrant would lose her citizenship. And she married a Swedish carpenter. And so when she died, she wasn't a citizen of the United States. I mean, it's just a we look back on those days as saying we welcomed everybody and there was free land in North Dakota and things like this, but it wasn't like that.
This was I'm not familiar with this. Professor Zelizer?
Well, we did allow huge numbers of immigrants into the country for over a decade, but starting in the 1910s and a little earlier, there were all sorts of restrictions that were put into place, culminating with immigration restriction reform in 1924 that essentially ended the influx of immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe. So it was about a 10-year period with members of both parties who reacted negatively and who were often fueled by nativist ideas that clamped down and ended immigration. So when Congress passes a reform in 1965, the whole point was to overturn the kinds of laws that the caller was talking about. And there were all sorts of stuff in the 1910s and 20s that motivated the anti-immigration drive, from concerns over jobs and economics to nativism and ideas that immigrants were somehow inferior and corrupting and posing a danger to the nation.
I didn't know that if you married an immigrant, you lost your citizenship.
Well, I don't know about that particular part of the provision. I'd have to look at it. But yeah, certainly there was a huge complex of laws at that time that included those sorts of restrictions.
Yeah, that's about it for phone calls. I'm sorry, everybody. We had a lot of response to this. So where do we stand with this in about 40 seconds? What's happening in terms of moving this forward?
Prospects are great. The incentives are all in place, and I think a lot of agreement exists on the major issues. Now it comes down to the politics of immigration, not simply the issue. And I think Obama and proponents of reform have to be very careful not to alienate the people who could make this deal, and in the next few weeks not give any reason for Republicans to listen to the hard line rather than to the rest of the party. If it's handled well, I think we could see a big piece of legislation in the next month or so.
Yeah. Thank you. It's always great to speak with you. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Julian Zelizer, our guest this hour. Been a little while since we've spoken with him, but it's always so informative. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and he's written a number of books on several presidents, Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. His latest book is Governing America, The Revival of Political History. He's also written a number of books on the New Deal. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to Katie Mattson for production help in beautiful downtown Milwaukee.